Tuesday, June 17th. This is Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. The horrifying assassination of a state representative in Minnesota has renewed focus on the rise in political violence in America. The number of threats and polling data bear out the fact that there seems to be increasing tolerance for, even support for, political violence. Today on the show, we're going to explore why and put this in the context of our nation's history. How does this era compare to prior eras? And we're asking you today on the show, what do you think is behind the rise in political violence? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2 at whyy.org. If you're on YouTube, drop a comment right there in the chat.
And I really hope today that people call in, that they email in, because the polling data shows that nearly one in four Americans believes that violence may be necessary to save the country. That's these numbers a little bit higher than they were just a few years ago. So we really want to hear from you, 888-477-9499. The email is studio2 at whyy.org. Trio of news stories, shall
we? Yeah, start us off, Cherry.
All right. The number of New Jersey and Pennsylvania-based immigrants deported by the Trump administration is up more than 80%. ICE, as you know, you probably heard on this show, has ramped up detentions and deportations amid pressure by the Trump administration. The government is now fast-tracking removals, incentivizing immigrants to self-deport, and they are enforcing deportation orders that have been sitting and basically ignored for years. These tactics have resulted in more than 2,000 people being deported from New Jersey and Pennsylvania in the month of March, even more in April, and federal removals are up 81% in Pennsylvania in April and 103% in New Jersey when compared to last year. And the Inquirer did a story. They have these charts that show the recent spike over the past few months in the number of removals under the Trump administration. And, you know, the Inquirer spoke to lawyers. They said that fast tracking this has made it harder for them to represent their clients. And I should mention that President Trump had said that he would be deporting criminals. But this surge is proving that they've been deporting people with no criminal histories and people who have been complying with the rules. They have been detaining people at court hearings and at check-ins, Javi.
Yeah, I mean, this is data that clarifies and, you know, puts some numerical weight behind something that we thought was happening. Mm-hmm. We just didn't have necessarily the data to explain it. But this is not a humongous surprise. I will note that you mentioned that these numbers are up over last year. However, if you go back a couple of years, mm-hmm. the numbers are still up, although the uptick is not as dramatic. Mm-hmm. And I'm talking about during the Biden administration a couple of years back.
Yeah.
So it's definitely unusual, although there had been months in like 2023 or so where the numbers were near this, not quite this level in Pennsylvania and New Jersey, but closer to the ballpark over last year. The spike is huge.
Yeah. Yeah. And I want to also mention that according to Axios, they did a story as well. They said that ICE had at least 14 deals with local law enforcement agencies in place as of Monday. All these deals are in Pennsylvania. A few more could come online soon. And this is where ICE works with local law enforcement to detain people. Of course, Philadelphia is a welcoming city where we have a sanctuary policy where our local law enforcement doesn't necessarily work with ICE unless ICE brings a warrant from a judge. And the same thing happens in Montgomery County, Delaware County. They also don't necessarily work with ICE, but there are a number of jurisdictions in Pennsylvania that do.
Yeah. Let's bring it down to the jurisdiction of Philadelphia, where we are starting to watch with increasing scrutiny the actions of Ask Me District Council 33. That is Philadelphia's largest municipal blue-collar union. They represent the folks who field 911 calls, fix potholes, collect trash, all sorts of pretty important things. And yesterday, 95% of members of District Council 33, at least according to the union, authorized a strike. That does not mean they are going on strike. It means they are saying to their union leadership, you can call a strike if we, the union, cannot come to a deal with the Parker administration, with the city. And that deadline for striking that deal appears to be, barring any extension, the end of this month. Check your calendar right now. It's June 17th. Getting close to the end of the month, folks. So there could be a massive municipal strike here in Philadelphia, the likes of which we haven't seen for about 40 years.
Yeah. And what's so interesting is the union has been signaling for weeks that they were willing to fight for what it seems to be benefits, sick time, some other issues, related to increasing, plus a raise. I think that was thrown in there. And a few weeks ago, they posted photos on Facebook of trash piled up from that strike you just mentioned back from 1986.
Yeah.
And so they were just putting that out there as a reminder.
Anybody remember
the stench from that time? Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I've lived through SEPTA strikes here. I've never lived through
a
District Council 33 strike. I can't imagine it's pleasant, especially in the summer months. So we shall see where all this goes. And it's worth noting that the back and forth here has been going on for months. Mm-hmm. Actually, a year ago, the union and the Parker administration agreed on like a 1-year extension.
Mm-hmm.
And now basically a year's up. So they've been at odds for a while.
Yeah.
It's clearly quite tense. We'll also note, one of the mayor's big promises
<That's it> right there
was cleaning and greening the city. Very difficult to clean and green without the members of District Council 33 doing that cleaning and greening. So this is a particular friction point, I think, for this particular administration. It's going to be interesting to watch it all play out.
Yep, we'll be watching. And our third story for Jay, the Washington Post dropped its 39 definitive rules of office fashion this morning. And why would they do something like this? Why do we need office fashion rules? Well, things have changed post-pandemic when it comes to office fashion. Most offices are now business casual. But what in the world does that mean? There are so many options, and that's why so many people go wrong. And so the Washington Post tried to help folks out. And the question is, where is the line? And there are a few rules, and I've highlighted
a few. There's
more
than a few. Yeah. There's 39.
Yeah. I'm just going to highlight a few. One is a cropped top is okay, but a crop top, no way.
That doesn't make sense already. Go ahead. I don't even care about the follow-up.
And then...
It's not for me, but I don't get it.
You can have peep toe and open toe shoes, but no flip-flops. You can't have flip-flops.
That's inconsistent,
in
but go ahead.
Yes. Also, pants, the higher the waist, the better. You can't have low waist. No crack at work.
The higher the waist, the better?
You can wear high waist pants.
So if I wear cartoonishly high-waisted pants, that's cool?
It's not necessarily cool, but it's okay. But what you can't do,
it's sanctioned,
is have low
fashion
rise pants where crack is showing. That's bad.
Hey, how about don't look at my butt?
And yes. And the other things that are dues is, by the way, you can't have too tight pants. There should be no bulges going on in the pants. And as far as the dues, backpacks are the new briefcase.
Wait, no bulges?
In
your never
pants.
Mind. Never mind.
Yeah, yeah.
Never mind.
Anyway,
I'll let it go.
Let it go, Avi. And also, dues. Backpacks have replaced briefcases. Jeans are now okay at work most days, and not just Fridays. You can wear cool socks. I know you've worn cool socks. That's a thing.
Sure.
And T-shirts. You would be happy about this. T-shirts are now okay at work.
Here's my problem.
Yeah. Go ahead. Lay it out.
As the resident
this
office.
This is a hot take coming. Go ahead.
No, it's not. It's not. As the resident office slob, I will tell you this. If you want to change my behavior, we need a code with far fewer than 39 rules. Anyone that's reading through 39 rules for office dress already is thinking about how they dress at the office. If you want to change the behavior of us over here at this end of the spectrum, the slob end, we need like 2-3 rules max. Maybe 5 rules.
But they had some giveaway. I mean, they put in BO. Come on. Like, no BO at work. That's technically, you don't really need that in the rules. So they had some junk rules in there. But I get you. 39 is kind of intimidating.
5 rules Max.
Five rules or less, says Avi Wolfman.
Five rules or less. If you want to reach people like me, if we want to reach people that already care about how they look at work, 39 rules is fine.
That's a lot. It is a lot.
Here I am lecturing the Washington Post as if that's my place. So we're going to go to a quick break. After we get back, we want to talk about something that's really serious.
Very serious.
The rise in political violence, something we're all thinking about after the horrific events in Minnesota. We want to hear from you. What do you think is behind the rise in political violence? Give us a call, 888-477-9499, or email studio2@whyy.org.
And welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt. Last year, the U.S. Capitol Police investigated nearly 10,000 concerning statements and direct threats against members of Congress. Now, as recently as 2017, that same number was below 4,000.
That data point is one of several suggesting a real and sustained uptick in political violence. So what's driving the trend? It's a question that looms larger after the recent assassination of Minnesota State Representative Melissa Hortman and her husband.
Political violence is a topic that terrifies and confounds many of us. Our guest today will help us unpack its causes and understand that uptick in the context of American history. Kurt Braddock is an assistant professor of public communication at American University. Kurt, thanks for being here.
Avi, good to be here.
It's really great to have you, Kurt. The same to Kevin Boyle, who teaches American history at Northwestern University and joins us via Zoom. Kevin, welcome to Studio 2.
Thanks so much for having me.
And for you, our listeners, we want you to participate in the conversation. Our question of the day is this: what do you think is behind the rise in political violence? You can call 888-477-9499 or email studio2@whyy.org to participate. And if you're watching on YouTube, be sure to leave your comments in the live chat. And so, gentlemen, I want to kind of take both of you back to when you first heard the news break about, you know, in Minnesota, there is a state representative and her husband gunned down. They've died. There's another state representative and his wife critically injured. Your thoughts in the context of the work that you do and knowing that this was an act of political violence. And Kurt, we'll start with you.
Well, unfortunately, I wasn't surprised. Like, I wasn't as taken aback as I feel like I should have been. But this seems like kind of the natural culmination of where we've been heading. We don't have to think too far back about there were kidnapping and assassination attempts on other high-profile politicians, Gretchen Whitmer being one of the most high-profile. But I was almost disappointed in the fact that I wasn't that surprised by the assassination or the attempt and the successful assassination, because we've kind of been heading in this direction.
So you kind of saw this coming. Kevin, your thoughts?
It's absolutely horrifying to read about it. I think one of the things that really struck me was that the victims of this attack weren't high-level profile politicians. Mm-hmm. They were state politicians. And I think that's one of the dynamics that's really changed in recent years, is the targets of violence have expanded out really dramatically.
Yeah, so let's talk about how this compares to the past. You marked that, Kevin Boyle, as a shift. The idea that the sort of the range of targets seems broader than it did. Does it seem broader than ever? Is this unusual even in the scope of American history?
Yeah, I think the United States, unfortunately, has a really long and bloody history of political violence, depending on how you define an act of political violence. There have been periods in American history, the early 20th century, a lot of the 1960s, where political violence was widespread. And I don't know for sure if I could say that the acts of political violence have grown bigger in that time, but I think they've shifted. You mentioned January 6th. That's a dramatic expansion of political violence. I'd be very hard-pressed to think of another incident that compares to a massive mob assault on the Capitol trying to stop one of the most fundamental moments in the American democratic process. So that's political violence reaching an epic scale. And on the other hand, there is this continual threat and now acts of violence against politicians who most people or political figures, most people wouldn't even know their names. I suspect there's all sorts of people in the United States who have no idea who their state representative is. And then there have been attacks on, threats on election workers. That's a movement down the scale at the same time that violence has moved up the scale.
Wow. I want to bring in a caller. We have Ryan from South Jersey. By the way, our big question of the day is, what do you think is behind this rise in political violence? Ryan, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Well, my comment is, my belief is that most of this political violence stems from the unsubstantiated, unregulated social media platforms. And their influences are just affecting individuals who, unfortunately, are easily influenced, easily swayed, and they just fall down the rabbit hole of the rhetoric. And I believe the rise of social media, which unfortunately is protected by the First Amendment, is what's fueling all this.
Yeah. Thank you. That's Ryan from South Jersey. And Kurt, I want to bring you back into the conversation. I mean, what does research sort of tell us about why political violence could be spiking now? And does Ryan have a point?
Ryan has a fantastic point. We find in research on the internet and the social media more specifically that people tend to isolate themselves when they get into social networks. And when they isolate themselves, they never hear any dissenting voices. So if they are going down, as Ryan very well put it, like a disinformation rabbit hole related to election denialism or some of the QAnon conspiracy theories or any of these conspiracy theories that drive a lot of the hatred that underlies political violence, when there's no dissenting voices there, then they just kind of whip themselves up into a frenzy in these echo chambers. And unfortunately, again, a great point Ryan made is that the social media outlets, the platforms, they're financially incentivized to facilitate that, because things like anger and things like interest in these conspiracy theories, that drives clicks, and those clicks drive advertising dollars. So the financial structure of the social media platforms incentivizes the development of those echo chambers.
Wow. And yet, you know, we just heard from mm-hmm. Kevin Boyle that there was this peak in political violence in the 60s and 70s. Now, this was a stat that really stood out to me. It's from Brian Burroughs, author of a book called Days of Rage. In a single 18-month period during 1971 and 1972, the FBI counted 2,500 bombings on American soil, wow. almost five a day. Now, a lot of those were not intended to harm people. They were bombings of sites where humans were not present, although some certainly did kill people. So the internet obviously could be a cause, right? But we have evidence of stark political violence prior to the internet age. Kevin Boyle, help me make sense of that.
Well, I think there's a couple of things at play, and I agree completely that the internet does help to fuel our current moment. But I think part of the dynamic as well is people commit violence. They actually go ahead and commit violence when they see whoever they're committing that violence against as a threat in some sort of way. Mm-hmm. And that's part of the politics that you were just mentioning in the early 1970s. That politics, though, the bombings that, say, were committed by the Weather Underground in the early 1970s, that came from a very fringe politics in the United States. There were very few members of the Weather Underground and very few sympathizers of the Weather Underground. One of the things that's really been a transformation now is the degree to which mainstream politicians are engaging in the sort of rhetoric that can lead people to see their political opponents, people they don't agree with, as fundamental threats to who they are or threats to the nation. Mm. And that's a really big transformation. You couldn't have found a Democrat or a Republican anywhere in America in 1970 or 1971 who was saying, well, I think the weathermen really have a point here. You know, that's not the way politics, mainstream politics, worked in the United States, and that's changed.
Yeah, and I want to bring in another caller. We have Catherine, who lives part-time in New Jersey and part-time in Florida, but clearly listens to Studio 2. Catherine, we appreciate that.
Full-time Studio 2. Yeah.
Catherine, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Absolutely. I just wanted to agree and say I feel so strongly that this is coming directly down from the president. You know, first he said it was okay to make fun of people, and then he said it was okay to be cruel to people. And then he said it was okay to beat people up during his rallies. And, you know, although this recent shooting was horrific, it certainly couldn't be surprising to anyone who's following politics.
Mm. Yeah. So Catherine, echoing something Kevin mm-hmm. Boyle said, but calling out the president by name, and Kurt Braddock, you were nodding along vigorously when Kevin Boyle was making that point. That seemed to really land with you. I wanted you to expand on what Kevin was saying and let us know what you were thinking as he was talking about how the rhetoric from the political mainstream affects all of this.
Yeah, I think that is, if we consider kind of social media to be the fuel, then the rhetoric we're seeing is like the match that lights it.
Mm.
What I study specifically is the way that major political figures, or even not political figures, just media mm-hmm. figures, when they make statements that they steer very clear of actually ordering violence, mm-hmm. but a lot of times they might allude to it, or they might wink and nod and say that, okay, violence might be okay. And to give you a couple of examples, in some of the speeches on January 6th, I think it was Rudy Giuliani who said, we need trial by combat here. Mm-hmm. The president at the time said, we need to fight. You need to get much stronger. You won't have a country anymore. Speaking to what Dr. Boyle talked about, they might lose something, which can be very motivational. So I've done a couple studies that show that when people are exposed to even these kinds of implicit messages that kind of go, wink, yeah, maybe violence is okay, a couple of things happen. Number one, people get more positive attitudes about actually engaging in violence. Mm-hmm. Number two, they think that violence is more normative, meaning they think other people will think it's okay if they engage in violence.
Ah.
And number three, they think that they actually have the power to successfully make changes by engaging in violence. So they think they can achieve their political goals if they engage in violence.
And it's so interesting to me, Kurt, because we did a show where people were telling Democrats to be meaner.
Mm-hmm.
And to be more forceful in their response. They felt like Democrats were being bullied by the Republicans. And we've seen that kind of come to change and shift.
Mm-hmm.
Even Governor Gavin Newsom of California has told people to stand up. I mean, do you see it also not just being from one side, but even mm-hmm. the reaction and response from the other side?
Oh, yeah.
Do you see that ramping up? And is that contributing to it as well?
Mm-hmm. So from the left, there are some examples of them doing this as well. A couple of years ago, Chuck Schumer stood on the Supreme Court steps right before Roe was overturned and said that these judges will reap a whirlwind if they do this. Maxine Waters, during protests at one point, I think it was during the Derek Chauvin trial, said that if they don't get a murder charge or a murder conviction, then we need to get in the police's face and show them we need mean business. So it has come from both sides, but to talk about the reality of it, it comes much more from the right. Now, I want to emphasize really quickly, this kind of language is First Amendment protected, and mm-hmm. it should be. But I argue that both the right and the left, if they start using language like you need to fight, you need to stand up, you need to be more aggressive, that it's incumbent on them as public speakers to say, I don't mean violence. Mm. And a lot of times these people aren't making that. They're not making that caveat. They're not saying that don't engage in violence. They're just letting people run with it.
Yeah.
When you tell someone to fight, to be tough, mm-hmm. you're appealing to, I would imagine, a pretty base human instinct, you know, this sort of, you know, fight or flight type of instinct. and, you know, these same humans with these same instincts have existed throughout history. So the question that I have for you, Kevin Boyle, is why is that appeal being made more now, when you would imagine it always had a chance to be effective, at least as a motivator, as an organizer, as a galvanizer? Why does it seem to be that more politicians, mainstream politicians, are using that type of rhetoric now?
Yeah, I think it is a really fundamental shift in the American political culture. And again, I don't want to say this never happened in the past. If you think about, say, the level of political violence that Southern states engaged in against civil rights protesters mm-hmm. was steeped in a lot of this violent language. I don't want to say it never happened before, but I think there was an extended period in the 20th century, in the early, particularly in the 20th century, where it was just understood that certain things were off the table. Mm-hmm. There were certain political language you just didn't engage in. And I think Kurt's point is really, really well taken about how politicians now will kind of go right up to the edge of talking about violence. But all I would add to that is it doesn't even have to be a political appeal that says, well, you know, violence might be okay. One of the really destructive things that is now happening is the ways in which politicians will label each other in extreme ways. So right after the shooting, mm-hmm. what does Senator Lee say except that these people were somehow Marxists?
Yeah, that's Mike Lee from Utah, by the way. Yeah.
Yeah, in the American political culture is to say they're un-American. Or when the president of the United States will call someone an animal. Well, once you dehumanize somebody, then it becomes way easier for you to commit an act, someone to commit an act of violence against that person.
But here's my follow-up question, Kevin. And sorry to cut you off, but
you
mentioned this period of almost detente where certain things were off limits and both parties seemed to abide by those rules. But in my mind, there was always an incentive for the politicians of any era to break those rules because it can be very powerful to use that type of language and you can really motivate people. You can turn people out. You can expand your base, clearly. So I'm trying to understand why it was ever off limits if indeed, you know, the main incentive for politicians is really often just to rile people up.
Well, I don't know if it's always to rile people up, because riling people up will also turn off huge numbers of voters. Donald Trump, for instance, mm-hmm. his polling numbers are actually quite negative. I mean, he's down by about 8 percentage points in his approval rating. So that's one strategy you can use. And like I said, sometimes politicians did this. George Wallace was brilliant at riling people up that way. But other politicians really saw it as both a negative in campaigning. Yeah. It's a kind of personal responsibility that you don't take chances like this because you do know that you could have results like what we're seeing now. It's a very dangerous game to play.
Yeah, and I want to invite our listeners to call in. The question is, what do you think is behind the rise in political violence? The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube, you can keep those comments coming in the chat. Paige says, people need to call out extremism on both sides of their own aisle, on both sides, far right and far left. We see violent behavior from both, and everyone is too self-righteous to admit that their side is instigating all of this. I want to read some stats because one thing that stood out to me is the rise in the number of people in the United States that is becoming more okay with the idea of violence. According to a recent poll from the Brookings Institute, a third of GOP supports violence as a means of saving the country, 22% of independents, and 13% of Democrats. And overall, it's about a quarter of America okay with this. This is up from 15% in 2021. I mean, what has sort of been the shift? And I think back, Kurt, to 2016 when President Donald Trump was running and then first elected, people were against this type of rhetoric. But now it's sort of like returning pound for pound. What changed in that short period of time, do you think?
I mean, there doesn't really necessarily need to be any major change. But in 2016, when he started using that kind of language and when kind of his subordinates and people trying to emulate him started using that language, it was shocking.
Yeah.
But one of the things that makes it easier to, as Dr. Boyle very well put it, dehumanize and demonize people is to normalize language around them that makes it seem as though they're less human or they are deserving of violence. And the more people are exposed to the kinds of language that we found shocking in 2016, the less they find it shocking. So, I mean, to give you an example, there was what I think was an assassination attempt on Governor Shapiro a couple of weeks ago. How long was that in the news? Three days?
Yeah.
2 days? How long would that have been in the news 15 years ago, that a governor's house was firebombed?
Every day.
Yeah. Every day. So this sort of thing is normalized now. So not to trivialize it, but things like racist rhetoric, xenophobic rhetoric, sexist rhetoric, rhetoric that advocates violence, it's become so normalized now that we're not shocked by it, and it becomes much easier to act on it when it doesn't seem like it's outside the norm.
And Kevin, my follow-up to you is, I think about the list of things that have happened just in the past few years, and I wrote it down. I was like, you know, we had a Republican shot during a baseball practice in Virginia. That was 2017. 2020, you know, the plot to kidnap Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer. 2020, we had also the George Floyd riots all over the country. 2021, January 6th happened. I mean, and then, you know, you had a plot to assassinate a U.S. Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh. I mean, there's so many things. And I want you to kind of, you know, add something to what Kurt was talking about. Have the American people sort of been primed by just the reoccurrence and the continuation of this happening to where now it's just become more acceptable?
Yeah, I think Kurt is absolutely right. I completely agree with that. That once you start, and I think this, Avi, comes back to your question, your really terrific question from a couple of minutes ago as well. Once you start to say that social norms have changed, that certain things are acceptable to say and they aren't accepted, that once weren't acceptable to say, then all of a sudden this starts to accelerate. I think this has been a process that's been going on, this deep, deep polarization of American politics, probably since the late 1980s or 1990s. And it's only accelerated as those guardrails start to fall off and certain behaviors become acceptable. I'll cite just one really dramatic example, I think. In his very first speech as a candidate in 2015, when Donald Trump announced his candidacy, he went to the most dangerous trope in American politics, which is the trope of the person of color, man of color particularly, as rapist. It's the most dangerous trope a politician can conceivably use in the United States. It was the basis for the great horror of lynching in the United States. And what politicians had done across the spectrum is refused to go there after the revolutions of the civil rights movements in the 1960s. He went there on the first day. And what that does is it announces there's a new standard. And as that accelerates, then we get exactly what Kurt was describing.
And, you know, because we are talking a lot about Donald Trump here, who we should point out has been the target of two assassination attempts himself. The question that always comes to mind to me is Trump more symptom or disease? Because he could say whatever he wants to say, but then there has to be a public willing to accept it and rally behind it. So you mentioned, right, Kevin, his first speech, he broke this big taboo, but then he rose in the polls, right? So it might just be that he's a mirror for something that all of us are feeling. I want you to talk a little bit about that, Kurt Braddock, and I'll also mention lots of people in the comments saying, you know, one of the causes of all this is that society's not working the way they want it to do. The system's not working the way they want it to work. They're angry.
Mm-hmm.
So I've set you up with a lot there, Kurt Braddock, but
yeah.
What part of that, gets a thought going for you?
So in terms of Donald Trump, and I'm, we have been picking on Donald Trump a lot, but let's say any major political figure who kind of goes into the tropes that David was talking about, I think they're both symptom and disease. I think they recognize that there's something in at least some part of the population that resonates with. And they kind of use it to their political advantage. I think that there are some politicians, some media figures who don't even necessarily believe what it is they're saying, but it's politically advantageous for them to use that kind of language and motivate a segment of the electorate. So I think it serves as both. I do think that whenever Donald Trump is no longer on the political scene, I think we'll see a shift in the way that the public talks, the way the public accepts these kinds of tropes.
Some sort of realignment, maybe.
I don't think we'll ever go back to where we were in 2014, 2013, but I think that we will see almost a correction in at least public rhetoric. In terms of people being dissatisfied with the way the system works, I would say I understand that, and anger is hugely motivational for people. But again, to look at those that use the kind of rhetoric that motivates people, a lot of the things that people perceive as the system not working is, again, people who are in positions of power leveraging things that aren't necessarily true and creating these sorts of problems that individuals believe are affecting them. They're politicians, others mm-hmm. are very good at identifying scapegoats for their own failings, and then they feel that the system is failing. That's not to say the system, whatever that means, isn't terrible sometimes. It absolutely is. But I also think that those in power often, rather than solve the problems that need solving, would rather find a scapegoat that motivate their electorate and then get elected in the next cycle.
And that's what Lauren says on YouTube. She says this violence is born out of a feeling that voting doesn't make a difference. The American people are suffering. And Democrat, Republican, it doesn't matter who gets elected. Neither party represents the voters here. Rachel also comments, Trump's violent rhetoric and pardoning the January 6th rioters are a part of this. And people keep pointing to the pardoning of the January 6th rioters as something that sort of amplified this. And I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, Kevin. I mean, you have a situation where, and I think back to the civil rights movement and times when people would commit crimes and no one would get in trouble for it, right? And it sort of stymied change that needed to happen. What do you think this sort of pardoning of the January 6th riots did to the political climate to contribute to this feeling that violence is okay?
Yeah, I think that it was a horrifically bad precedent to set. And the blanket side of those pardons was particularly striking. It made no distinction between someone who broke in, not to excuse any of them, but to someone who broke into the Capitol and wandered around for 25 minutes and left, and people who actively attacked law enforcement officers. Made no distinction whatsoever on that front. So I think it was just another contributing factor to this general sense that lawlessness, that violence can be a legitimate thing. It was a sign of legitimation. I think it's true. I'll just add that, of course, we are talking a lot about Donald Trump. Donald Trump's the most powerful man in American politics and has been for a decade now. So I think it's understandable that we're talking about him. But yes, it's a problem that extends beyond one man.
Mm. Yeah. Let's bring in a caller now. Mm-hmm. This is Jerry from Springhouse, Pennsylvania, who I think is going to echo something we heard earlier from Kevin Boyle. Jerry, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment? Jerry, are you with us? Okay, I think we lost Jerry. Oh, that's too bad. Well, look, let's talk about what it takes potentially to break this cycle, because it does feel like we're in some sort of downward, upward spiral, whatever direction you want to point to, and we can't get out of it. But let me read in this comment from Margaret, who says, to combat the notion that violence is needed to protect democracy, I suggest the 3.5% rule, a comprehensive study by historians of nations like the Philippines that have pushed back against totalitarian takeover, shows that nonviolent protest by 3.5% of citizens works and violent protest does not. I've been hearing about this 3.5% rule, and maybe you have as well, Kurt Braddock, and it does present a different vision for how to make change. And I wonder if that's somehow going to be the thing that breaks whatever cycle we're in. Or if not that, then what? Give us some ideas.
Well, there's a couple of things. Number one, I wasn't familiar with the 3.5% rule until just this past week after the No Kings protests and how positively they seem to have been received by everybody who participated and people who watched. So I believe that that's actually the case. I'm a big proponent of nonviolent protests. And what I see as my job as a researcher isn't to change somebody's political alignment, no matter how abhorrent I think it is. I just want them to engage in nonviolent show of that. I think that would actually be really useful. I also, individuals who I've talked to who have been implicated in political violence in the past, they've actually said they felt duped by those who motivate them to engage in violence. So I think one of the things that I work to do is to study how we can make people aware of the fact that there are these communicative strategies that people are using to get them to engage in certain activities, make them aware of those so they can avoid getting themselves in trouble. And one of the things that I think is really, really important, and it's been talked about, and I'll leave it to Kevin to discuss it historically, is exposure to people who are different from yourself. There have been a number of studies that show that just mere exposure to somebody different from you demographically, politically, culturally, it kind of humanizes them. So we talked about dehumanization of the other. We can rehumanize people by exposing people to each other.
And yet I've read, and I don't know, you know, the exact extent to which is this true, but that we are living physically more and more in bubbles, whether what neighborhood we choose to live in tends to have sort of a political tilt to it. So if that's one of the prescriptions, I wonder if that medicine is not within reach anymore.
I think it can be. I think that we have to make an actual concerted effort to make it happen. Not to, again, blame social media and cell phones, but a lot of it has to do with most people are happy on their couch with their cell phone just flipping through it. So just as one example, and this is not meant to be definitive, but a couple of years ago, I was doing some work on kind of avoiding this problem in a city, a small city in the UK. And the way that they facilitated this was that they found kind of community leaders, people who had a lot of sway in the area that weren't necessarily politicians. And it was seven women. One woman ran like a sewing circle. One did like kind of tea chats and things like that. And these would draw young people in and they would talk. And in that talking, they would be exposed to people different from themselves. And they would be less inclined to engage in violence on that. So I think organization at the local level is key.
I also want to ask both of you the question of what do you think these politicians can do? And I think about it because there used to be a time when, you know, when you saw an act of violence this horrific that happened in Minnesota, that you would see everybody, regardless of political affiliation, standing together at a press conference, talking together, right? And now you have different statements. There were some comments from the president who said that he didn't even call the governor of Minnesota. And so I just your thoughts as we get ready to wrap up about, is there a way to sort of de-escalate all of this in a fast way? And we'll start with you, Kevin.
Yeah, I think the fundamental point, and I'm just agreeing with Kurt, is the way the world is not how the world has to be. The world can be changed. That social media has become a very destructive force, but it doesn't inherently have to be a destructive force. What we need to do is have the political will and the personal courage to say that this must stop and that we must try to recreate the sort of world or create the sort of world where people don't see each other as enemies, who don't demonize each other. And we've seen that happen. It's a tough thing to do. I've spent a lot of time studying the civil rights movement. Martin Luther King's great genius was to say we could build a world based on love. Take someone to say that, to have the courage to make that leap instead of moving in the opposite direction.
I think we have time here for one more caller. This is Elvis from University City on line one. Elvis, we are a little short on time, but real quick, what's your question or comment?
I just wanted to ask how you guys think that statements made by Democrat politicians like Tim Walz villainizing Donald Trump and equating him to Hitler, how that kind of factors into the polarization of politics and the increased political violence.
Yeah, that's a fair question. Yeah. Could you answer that, Kurt? Because we've certainly heard plenty of strong statements about Donald Trump from Democratic politicians.
Yeah, of course. And I would say that calling somebody Hitler, it's not helpful. I would say that, first of all, because Hitler, beyond just being a fascist dictator, he's almost like a symbol in the American consciousness now. Yeah. So it's certainly, at the very least, it's not helpful and it increases polarization. I think it's kind of on par with when right-wing politicians kind of dismiss somebody as a Marxist, which, again, in the American consciousness is the enemy given the Cold War and everything. So I really don't think it's helpful. I think the caller has a very good point there.
Yeah. And so many great points raised by both of you this hour. And I just want to thank you and thank our callers and commenters because, we know this is a tough conversation to have, but we feel like it's an important conversation to have, and we think this is a good forum to have it in. So thank you so much Kurt Braddock, assistant professor of public communication at American University, and Kevin Boyle, professor of American history at Northwestern University.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And also thank you to our producer. Studio 2 is produced by Debbie Builder, Paige Murray Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer. Al Banks and Tina Calliquet engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory. I'm Cherry Gregg from Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia.
And from that same studio, I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We will talk to you tomorrow.